Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. I hope you are well. Check it out. Something special today. We've got Joseph Wang in the house who just came out with an amazing blog post, and we're going to dive into this. I was going over this with my research analyst, Josh, and we pulled this up and I was going through it and I was just blowing my mind. I said, man, it would be great to actually get Joseph on a live stream so he could help me explain this to people, because I think it's so important that people really get their head around it. So here he is, live in the flesh. Joseph Wang, how you doing, my friend?
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for inviting me, George.
Yeah, let's dive into your article. So yep. This, let's go ahead and tell people where we're going. Maybe they can follow along on their computer. We're at fedguy.com. And I noticed for me, I had to hit the home link and that's when it came up. So go to fedguy.com, hit home. And then the last blog post called Inflationary Hikes, November 1st. So I think the first paragraph here, you're kind of outlining your ideas. Do you want to summarize that, Joseph?
Sure. So, you know, generally when people think about rate hikes, they think that it tamps down on inflation, right?
And right.
There's mechanisms in the banking system how that would work in the past. But the thing is, I think there's been a structural change in how the banking system operates, such that when you have hikes now, it might not work as well. In fact, it may even be inflationary. And I think the way to think about that would be to realize that, and as you've noted many times, George, so banks are creators of credit, right? They create money. So one of the ways that you can think about inflation is that when banks create a lot of money, when there's a lot of credit creation, then, you know, there's more economic activity and, you know, that's upward pressure for inflation. So in the past, the way that banks would work would be, let's say they would borrow short in the funding markets, right? The money markets, and they would have longer term assets.
Yeah. And, so let's go. This is prior, okay. Just to explain, this is prior to the GFC.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. What we have the Fed funds rate would kind of determine the interbank lending overnight. So if there was a bank that did a loan for $1 billion, and that was a new dollar denominated liability they created. Let's say they had to transfer that liability to another bank. They needed an asset to back that up. So they'd have to transfer bank reserves that's a liability of the Fed. If they didn't have those bank reserves, they would have to borrow them. So they would have to borrow those from another bank. And then hopefully the loan was a higher interest rate than the amount on the bank reserves they have to borrow. They pocket the spread.
Exactly. So banks actually did not really care what level of interest there was, because like you just mentioned, they pocket a spread. So when the Fed funds rate goes hot, when the Fed hikes rates, for example, then, you know, they just kind of pass on that hike to the borrower. And even though they just pocket that spread, so they don't really care.
So or to the depositor. So before, and I think you mentioned this, Joseph, you've got the customer deposits, they're paying, right, Let's say a 1% interest rate. And then they would use those reserves, or if they had to borrow the overnight rate, then that overnight rate would be a higher interest rate, I think, than they would pay their depositors. And that's why the depositors, that was cheaper bank reserves, basically.
That's a separate channel that you're exactly right. So basically when the Fed raised rates, then maybe the banks would try to compete for cheaper deposits. So they might people who have checking accounts slightly higher interest rates, right? So that's another channel that we also talk about in the article. But just finishing through this idea.
Yeah, sorry about
so
that.
So back then, when the Fed would raise rates, for example, then the bank would pass that on plus the spread to the end borrower. And obviously, when rates are higher, there's probably less demand for credit, right? So when you raise rates, you dampen the amount of credit creation in the bank done by the banking system. And that kind of slows the economy down, right? But there's a structural change in how the banking system works now, and that banks don't really use borrowing money markets. They don't borrow in the federal funds market anymore. They're basically completely funded by retail deposits. Now, retail deposits are basically interest rate insensitive. So even if the Fed hikes rates to 2, 3, 4%, your typical retail depositor doesn't care. And so that means that rates are still zero for them.
So, and I want to point out too, the banks aren't competing for those deposits as much because they're flushed with reserves because the Fed has taken their balance sheet from $800 billion to $8
trillion. And not just that. I mean, the enormous amount of fiscal spending, right? So when you were giving free checks to people, you're basically directly giving it to retail people, right? So that ends up as a retail deposit. So
if it's backed by the bank reserves that were created by the Fed monetizing the debt in the first place.
Yes. QE creates enormous amounts of deposits. That you can go to Fred, you can see that chart. And in the article, we'll also see specifically the best kind of deposits, retail deposits, have just surged in the past 2 years. So now when you hike rates, then a bank actually receives more interest income, but its liabilities, the amount, its funding costs don't change. So with every hike, banks are actually encouraged to create more credit, and that was not the case in the past. So let's say if you the Fed hiked 4% back pre-GFC, the bank would not really care because they make that same spread. But today, now that's with every hike, they're making a wider spread, and that encourages more credit creation. And more credit creation, you know, more loans, lower standards, that's obviously inflationary. So that's kind of this weird, I guess, pro-cyclical loop that we're in. And that's just one channel. And the other channel was obviously the one that impacts us more directly, and that's our deposit rates. So another way you can think about rate hikes tamping down on economic activity is that everyone has higher interest rates on their checking accounts, right? So they're more reluctant to spend. On the margins, if you were receiving, let's say, 2% in your bank checking account, maybe you would be slightly less likely to spend that money. So back pre-GFC, when banks were funding themselves in money markets, they were competing for these deposits. And but now that's totally different. And as you just mentioned, George, QE created tremendous amounts of deposits. Now the banks, they don't even have to compete for deposits anymore. So no matter, well, I won't say no matter, but even if the Fed raises rates significantly, we're still probably going to get 0% on our checking account. So that channel of raising the opportunity cost of money for retail people like me, that's not going to be there. And so that's another way that this mechanism is kind of broken. But that's kind of like a high level view. And I guess if we walk through the piece with some charts, it'll kind of come together.
Yeah, let's do that before we or at least I scroll down. I'm right at the marginal cost to marginal return. I want to hopefully understand the your idea that higher interest rates would increase or potentially increase bank lending. So the way I see that is, and we didn't talk about IOER. Or IOR.
That's exactly right.
What we've moved from is this environment where we've got the overnight rate to where people are paying for money, but now the Fed is paying them the park money, you know, to keep park those bank reserves at the Fed. If you want to look at it, the bank reserves denominated in dollars, and therefore, if they are getting paid, let's say 1%, then that is you know, profit that's going to the bank. If they are paid, let's take it to an extreme, they go from 1% to being paid 10% on the $4 trillion worth of bank reserves that are parked at the Fed roughly right now, that would mean they're making a lot more profit. Well,
For doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah. So then where does that profit come from? Well, the Fed would just create those bank reserves out of thin air. And therefore, the amount of bank reserves that they would have parked at the Fed would increase dramatically. And if the amount of bank reserves that they have on their balance sheet, the commercial banks, if the amount of bank reserves they have as assets on their balance sheet increases massively, then theoretically, their balance sheet capacity increases. So they're able to issue more loans because they've got more reserves to back them up. Is that kind of the logic?
So I think banks are motivated in part by how much money they make from creating a loan, right? So there's that channel, the IOER channel, that's definitely right. So every time the Fed raises IOER, that's basically more money going to the that's more profits to the banks.
Right.
But
right.
In terms of actually creating credit, though, it encourages banks to create more credit because they make larger spreads. Their funding costs are stuck at zero because of the retail funding, retail deposits that are flooded the system. But their lending rates keep increasing with every rate hike. And like you mentioned, so in this new regime, the way that rates work, though, instead of controlling the funding costs of banks, they actually controls the asset returns of banks. So that's IOR. Right. So basically a bank, instead of when it wants to make a loan, for example, one of the things that it would think about is, you know, what if I just leave my this cash at the Fed? I earn, let's say, 1% IOR. I won't have to do anything, right? So the loans that it makes will have to be greater than
I was just going to mention 1%. That. So it doesn't mean that people's mortgages will stay the same if their interest rate on their bank deposits stay the same, because that mortgage rate would have to exceed the rate of IOR, or else they're not going to do the loan in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And usually, when you have like a mortgage, you know, it's 30 years, so it's upward sloping term structure. So it's usually higher.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So I think I'm definitely on the same page. And by the way, Joseph, I think I might want to do a whiteboard video on this.
I love your whiteboard videos.
I understand it. Yeah. All right, cool. So now I'm going down to marginal cost to marginal return. So in practice, implementation of monetary policy through banks has changed from adjusting the marginal cost of funding to adjusting the marginal return on assets. So this is exactly what we were talking about.
Exactly right. And you can see that just revolution in that chart here. So before the GFC, let's say banks were funding maybe 30-40% of their liabilities in rate sensitive money markets, right? So these are liabilities whose interest rates follow very closely the Fed funds rate. Right. So if the Fed were to hike rates, then that 30-40% of money market liabilities, it would also adjust upwards with it. Now, that's completely changed today when we can see maybe 10% of their liabilities are these wholesale liabilities. Right. And the part of that is by design. So during the Great Financial Crisis, so one of the ways you can think about the GFC was that it was kind of a giant bank run, right? So a lot of banks were borrowing, let's say, three months, 6 months in term, and taking that money and investing in assets that matured in several years. Mm. So there's that maturity mismatch. So when the Fed was hiking rates then, or maybe, no, not necessarily hiking rates. So if for whatever reason, the people who are lending them 3 month or 6 month money did not want to continue lending them, then what they would have to do is they would have to sell their assets to repay those short-term loans, right?
Yeah.
When everyone does that, there's it cascades into an avalanche of selling. Asset prices go lower. More lenders get skittish. More people withdraw loans, and so
especially when you have mark-to-market accounting.
Yeah,
and even if you're not selling, your balance sheet's taking a massive hit.
Yes, exactly. And you know, lenders who are lending them like 3 months or 6 months see that, and then they panic, and then they withdraw, and then that means more people are losing access to funding. That means more fire sales. So you have basically a standard bank run, and that's what happened during the GFC. And in order to prevent that, there's this new set of regulations. It's called Basel III.
Right.
And so it raises the costs of regular costs to banks who fund themselves more in the money markets. So it encourages banks to not do that. It encourages banks to either borrow, let's say, liabilities that mature for a year or more, or to have retail deposits. And that's part of the shift you see here. You have a whole bunch of banks just kind of consciously changing their funding profile so that they're not borrowing short-term money anymore, but they have a very stable funding base that won't run when the market craters.
Yeah. Now, I'm trying to think this through. How do you think QT would, well, I guess they're not talking about that yet. So what they'd have to do is they'd have to reduce the amount of QE they're doing down to zero.
Yes.
And then they could go ahead and raise interest rates, and then they could do QT. I'm just thinking if they do QT, then that would really reverse what we're talking about.
Yes. So QT would shrink the amount of deposits in the banking system. It takes out reserves, but reserves are just one side of the balance sheet. The other side is usually a deposit. But this is kind of getting in the weeds a little bit, but deposits come in different types of qualities. Usually when the QT is kind of shrinking, it's kind of the low quality deposit that, let's say it's a deposit held by a hedge fund manager that does not have good regulatory treatment anyway. So it won't matter that much.
And probably a low velocity deposit.
Yeah. Well, it's all spent on financial assets, right? So they don't.
Yeah.
Really...
That's what one thing I've been trying to do lately is just, is really differentiate the dollars that are liabilities of the commercial banking system. I try to compartmentalize those dollars that are liabilities of the commercial banks, but yet are assets of financial institutions in the private sector. And then also compartmentalize the dollars that are liabilities of commercial banks that are actually assets of non-bank entities in the real economy. Because in my mind, it just seems like those dollars that were on the balance sheet of the non-bank entities would circulate at probably a higher velocity because they're the ones that are out there chasing goods and services. Whereas the dollars that are on the hedge fund's balance sheet, although they're still liabilities of the commercial bank, they're not out there buying cars and cheeseburgers and retail products from Walmart every day. Yeah.
Who holds the money is really important in understanding on how this whole thing works.
Yeah. Cool. So let's go down and just kind of take it chart by chart. I think that's probably the easiest thing to do.
This goes back to the surge in retail deposit story that we've seen. So can see that the level of retail deposits increased, let's say, $5 trillion over the past 2 years. And that's basically all from...
Is that all, Joseph?
These are just retail deposits. If you look at the non-retail retail deposits...
I can't believe we've had inflation. That doesn't make sense.
I've actually done a little bit of work about who holds the money that's increasing. And there's just this amazing chart that I have. And you can... On one of my... actually, my former post, where you see...
You want me to go over there really quick?
Yeah.
Let's do that for the viewers so they can see that. So I'm going to go.
I mean, this is exactly your point too. That about.
So how do I get to? Do I go to forum?
No, just home. Go to home and just scroll down. Okay. Yep, scroll down. That's this one. Continue reading. Yep. So,
chart.
Just lower down a little bit. Yes, this one. You can click it. I think.
Right here.
You can click. Yeah, that one. So, this is money held by the. Held by households, so not businesses, this is checking account money. So this is not savings account. That's another graph. It's just in your checking account, and that $2 trillion surge—that's all from pandemic transfer payments. So you think inflation? The government basically printed trillions of dollars and gave it to like mom and pop, right? So
I always look at M2 or their new version of M2. And it's not as dramatic actual checking accounts, right?
This is a study that you were talking about. Checking accounts from households, so not corporations, not the government, not financial sector entities, just households. So this comes from two things. One is the, just stimulus checks, right? And the other is PPP loans. So people don't talk about PPP loans, but the PPP loan program, I think it was like $800 billion, and there's another $300 billion in something related. So it basically gave $1.1 trillion to small businesses. Part of it has to go to payroll, but that's just off the magic money tree. So that filters through to this, through wages to this, and that filters, and the transfer payments from the stimulus checks do as well. So this is just amazing. And you think that we have so much, people wonder why we have inflation in goods. Well, people are buying stuff because they have a lot of money because the government gave them that for free.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay, let me get back to the article we were discussing. That was really dramatic. I've got to use that on my whiteboard.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, right? It's amazing.
Yeah, that's an eye opener. Okay, so now we're down at hiking earnings. And it looks like we've got a chart here, JPMorgan Chase 12-month pre-tax.
So this is going back to the pre-GFC framework when a bank would match its liabilities with its assets. So in this context, for example, thinking back pre-GFC, a bank would borrow short in money markets, 3 months, 6 months money. And the rates that they paid on that money would be closely tied to the Fed funds rate. And they would, on the asset side, they would have loans that were also kind of indexed to the Fed funds rate. Well, probably LIBOR, right. But moves with the Fed funds rate. Right, so right. In that context, when the Fed hikes rates or reduces rates, the higher interest rate costs that a bank has to pay is offset by the higher interest revenue it gets from its loans. And that's kind of the bank's business. Like you noted before, they make a spread. They're not really there to take interest rate risk. And so back then, that chart was to show that even if rates went up 200 basis points, then, you know, JPM, I mean, it didn't really affect their earnings because they hedged their interest rate costs on both on their expense and their income side so that they're just locking in that spread.
Right.
If we go down a little bit, you'll see that business model has completely changed.
So now we're down to the next chart, the firm's U.S. dollar sensitivities.
It's completely changed because now they don't borrow in the money markets, the rate-sensitive money markets. All their funding is in rate-insensitive deposits. So when rates go higher, it's just pure income to them. Mm. So they're not just taking a flat spread. They're taking like an expanding spread. So if rates were to shift up 100 basis points, their earnings increased by $6 billion. So that's very different from the past, right? That just shows that the higher the rates are, the more money they make, and they're more incentive to create credit, to make loans. It doesn't actually have to be a loan to a business too. It could be buying treasuries, which is what Bank of America is doing to the tunes of hundreds of billions as well.
Yeah, so let's unpack this idea because I don't think people are going to follow this unless we really explain it. So let me try to explain it to the best of my ability and then tell me if I'm getting it correct. So what happens when a bank buys a treasury from a non-bank entity, so let's just say the average Joe and Jane, is that treasury would go from the balance sheet of the average Joe to now it's an asset on the balance sheet of XYZ Bank, let's say JP Morgan. Well, how are they going to pay for that? Well, what they would do is they would transfer the bank reserves over to the average Joe's bank. Let's say that's with Wells Fargo. And they would also create another liability. Let's say that the average Joe's sold the treasuries for $1 million. So then the $1 million in bank reserves would go from JP Morgan's account to Wells Fargo. But then Wells Fargo would also create a dollar denominated liability, which would be an asset of the average Joe for the $1 million. That's how he would get paid. But those $1 million did not exist prior to JP Morgan buying that treasury. They only existed as bank reserves on the Fed's balance sheet denominated in dollars. They were not a commercial bank liability. Therefore, they could not circulate in the real economy. Do I have that correct, Joseph?
So I would focus more on the deposit side. So you're exactly right. So if the reserves are shift to the other bank, but you know, I would focus more on the deposit liability stuff because that's deposits are money that you know non-banks hold and use.
Yeah,
freely.
But the bottom line is in that example, the average Joe now has $1 million that he did not have before.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
More importantly, I guess what you're saying, more importantly, we got to focus on the fact that those are an additional $1 million in dollar denominated liability that the commercial banking system has. Therefore, in layman speak, that's an extra $1 million circulating in the economy that was not there before. M2 money supply, or that chart we just looked at, went up by $1 million.
Yes, you're exactly right. So that's what happens. It happens when a bank makes a loan, also when it buys a treasury, just like you described.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So now let's also go over this sentence, because this sentence in and of itself, I think, is a whiteboard video. I'll read it here, and then you can walk us through. The new dynamic suggests rate hikes lead to a flatter yield curve, lower nominal rates, and potentially higher inflation through increased credit creation. And then you're saying, remember, guys, bank security purchases, and this is what we just went through,
exactly,
are paid for through the creation of money. So we understand how that creates more dollars, that could create more inflation, but how does that create a flatter yield curve and lower nominal rates?
Because you have a bank there. Well, you have banks there willing to buy, let's say, 5 to 10 year treasuries just when it goes higher, because their funding cost is zero, and right, for them, owning treasuries is regulatory neutral. It's treated the same as reserves on their balance sheet. So if they have like $1 million in reserves yielding, let's say, 1%, and suddenly the 10-year treasury got to 3%, you know, they could just swap that out and hold treasuries instead,
right?
And they would make more money. They would, you know, make 3% instead of 1%. Their funding costs would be still zero. So, and if they were worried about further changes in interest rate risk, they could hedge that as well. And we actually already see Bank of America doing that to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, just buying treasuries and mortgages. And JP Morgan has said that they would do something similar, but they're still waiting for rates to go a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. So if you have these giant banks just waiting to buy treasuries when they go a little bit higher, that kind of puts kind of a soft cap there on how high interest rates can go. Because remember, for them, their funding costs are zero, and they have these regulatory constraints where they either have to hold treasuries or hold reserves. And so that's just an enormous amount of buying power there.
Yeah.
Kind of limits how high treasuries can go. Now, even if you think inflation is like really high, then you have these people who don't really care about where inflation is. What they care about is how it is compared to IOR and how it is compared to their funding costs, which is zero. So you kind of already see this happening, and you probably see more of it as time goes on. So that kind of, one is a ceiling, and it flattens the curve, because where they're buying is probably like 5 to 10 years, whereas the short end of the curve, let's say 3 months, 1 year, 2 years, that's very sensitive to the Fed's policy rate, and that can go up and down.
Right.
And so as the Fed hikes, so the front end, the 3 month, 2 year, is going to go higher, but that 5 to 10 year, it's kind of going to stay around there where it is, or maybe go a bit higher. So that flattens the curve a bit.
Yeah, that's so, Josh, that's exactly what I thought. Josh and I were sitting there noodling over that, Joseph, for about 5 minutes. And I'm like, I think he's talking about this happening, and I got it right. So I'll go
exactly
ahead and
right.
give myself a pat on the back there. And for those people, I don't know if I said it at the beginning, but Joseph used to work at the Fed. He was in charge of the New York Fed's trading desk. So you're talking to the guy that actually did quantitative easing. When Jerome Powell says, hey, we got to do another $120 billion in QE, Joseph was the guy that would actually do it. So it's really an honor to have you on. Let's keep going down to this next chart. And this is rate hikes do not pass through to depositors.
Yeah. So this goes to what you were speaking about earlier, George. I mean, Usually, so Fed hikes rates, and we think that slows the economy down. It does so in many different ways. One of them, it used to be that it slows credit creation. But another way that it would do that is by raising the opportunity cost of money for everyone. So hypothetically, let's say your checking account was offering you 5% interest. Maybe you wouldn't want to spend as much money because, you know, if you left your money in your checking account, you'd earn 5%, right? So that's one channel where rate hikes can, higher rates can dampen economic activity, slow down inflation. But if you have a banking system that is just awash with retail deposits, and just remember that chart a couple charts ago, yeah, we increased retail deposits by $5 trillion. So banks aren't really going to compete with, don't have any reason to raise their checking account interest. Because, you know, if you don't like it, there's nowhere for you to go, and they don't really need your deposit. They have so many. So, yeah. You know, it's classic supply and demand. You increase the supply of deposits, and, you know, there's just the price of each deposit goes down. So you're not willing to pay higher interest rates. We actually saw that happen last time around, too. So last time around, we had a bunch of QE deposits. And you can see in this graph, you can see the Fed funds rate hiking. But you don't know the... Up a little bit.
Oh, right here?
Yes. You can. So this is okay. The red chart. The red line is the Fed funds rate.
Okay.
And the almost impossibly low blue line is it's what was offered to deposits by banks. And so,
oh, yeah. So you can see it didn't even budge, even though Powell was raising rates. Yeah.
Powell's raising rates and nothing happened.
And just to your earlier point, guys, just so everyone's clear. Prior to the GFC, when this functioned kind of in a more normal environment, this blue line would have notched up. It would always be a lower, but it would notch up with the Fed funds rate.
Yeah.
And now that we're the system that's just flushed with reserves and IOR, where the Fed actually pays banks to leave their deposits, if you will, for lack of a better word, at the Fed, then you just see this environment where basically the retail's just getting screwed or and being forced further and further out the risk curve, even if rates are increasing at the front end.
Yes, you're right. I mean, like, so rate hikes don't, so that deposit channel, that increasing the opportunity of money, increasing the opportunity cost of money channel of slowing down inflation, that's not going to work this time around. We won't see any interest rate hikes in our deposit accounts.
And then Joseph, I noticed in the next sentence you're talking about reverse repo, and I know that's something that everyone's talking about. I think, you know, when we did our last interview, my memory serves me right. I think reverse repo is up to about $1 trillion. We talked about it, but now I think it's up at like 1.6 trillion, isn't it?
Yeah, it's up there. It's up there. It's going to stay up there and until the debt ceiling is resolved. What that is basically so money market funds don't have anything to invest in because money market funds usually invest in treasury bills, but because of the debt ceiling, then treasury is kind of trying to reduce its debt down so it could stay under the ceiling, right? So that means it's not issuing as many treasury bills as it otherwise would. Money funds don't have anywhere to place their money. They just place it into the RRP.
Okay, but you make a note that if the Fed did raise rates, then this would mean more profits not only for the banks but for the money market funds.
Yes. So just a moment ago we were talking about how banks have tons of deposits, so they have no need to compete for deposits, right? So deposit rates will stay low. But there is one wrinkle to this, and that's the RRP. So the RRP is basically lending money to the Fed, or basically a deposit account at the Fed. And if they raise the rates to say 5%, that offers a little bit of competition. Because if I had a checking account at Citibank and they were paying me zero, then I can move my money to a money market fund who would then invest into the RRP for 5%. And the money market fund would take a cut, but, you know, I'd get like 4%. So
they're more focused on basically AUM. Assets under management, where the banks don't care about that right now.
Right. So the money market funds, you know, they make, let's say, 0.5% off their assets. So the bigger the asset base, the more money they make. So Yeah, so they would basically invest your money and then take a cut and then pass the rest to you. Now, that potentially gives some competition that could raise deposit rates. But the truth is that retail deposits are just very insensitive. In that last chart, you can see that basically no one was moving money into money market funds until the Fed got to 2.5%. And now that's like a year or two from now, and it's probably going to be, so that it's slowly, it has an effect, but the effect is it's really weak and it takes a long time.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move down to this next chart. It's like money market fund assets, net yield. I guess this is what we were just referring to.
Yep. So you can see the moment when the Fed funds rate, which is the orange one, got to about 2.5, that's when the gray line, which is the money market fund assets, started to increase. So that's the point when people were like, yeah, 2.5%, it's better than zero, so I'm going to start moving my money. And that's what starts the competition for deposits and would encourage some banks to offer slightly higher deposit rates.
Got it. Okay, so now we're moving down to the borrowing channels remain. And looks, I guess we don't have a chart here, but again, this last paragraph, I think, is a whiteboard video in and of itself. So do you want to walk us through these two paragraphs and we'll kind of focus on your conclusion?
Yeah. Right? So we're talking about different mechanisms that rate hikes slow the economy down and lower inflation. One mechanism that still works is just higher borrowing costs. When the Fed hikes rates, your mortgage rate will go higher. Let's say your auto loans and maybe different business loans will go high depending on what they're indexed to. So the cost of borrowing will go higher. So that's true. But another way to think about this is you have to realize that effect of having higher borrowing costs might not have a very big impact on economic activity to begin with. One of the ways you can see this is that everyone has just tons of money and they don't really need to borrow. The big corporations, they're taking their money and they're buying back stock, right? So they have so much money, they're giving money back to their shareholders. If you look at the smaller businesses, they just got like $1 trillion in PPP loans. They're flush with cash as well. If you look at the retail households, and we just looked at that amazing chart, you can see that $2 trillion surge in checking account deposits. They have a lot of money too. So even if you're hiking interest rates, it might not have that big an effect on the economy because people don't really need money right now. Mm. And if you just take a step back, we had zero interest rates for like 10 years and that really didn't do anything to the economy or inflation. So the cost of money, it's just kind of one input into like a whole other thing, a lot of other things that matter when it comes to determining economic activity. It's what the Fed focuses on since it's the only thing that it can control. But, sometimes it's not the most important thing.
Right. And also, too, if you read the textbooks, I've never read one myself, but I think what they say is that one of the reasons for lowering interest rates is to pull demand for borrowing forward from the future into the present.
Yeah,
that makes total sense. Increase aggregate demand. And if we've had 0% interest rates for, call it, 10 years, we have pulled as much of that demand for lending into the past as probably existed.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, everyone who could borrow and wanted to borrow has already borrowed, right?
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
10 years at zero.
All right. So let me read this last paragraph. The primary impact of Fed hikes will likely be through the financial channel. Every hike reduces the market value of fixed income investments, with the losses transmitted more broadly through the often leveraged portfolios of investors. Why? Because they've got this 60-40 split, the risk parity portfolio. Exactly. The good news is that the reverse wealth effect channel has a reliable record of subduing inflation by tanking all commodity prices. And that's very interesting because I know a lot of us are interested in commodities themselves as far as from an investment standpoint.
Yeah, I just think that I don't think rate hikes have that big of a effect on the real economy unless you get, you know, go to really high rates, and we're not going to get there. But it seems to have a huge impact on the financial economy. If you think back to 2018, quarter four, we got to 2.5 hikes. Fed was telling you in their December meeting that they're going to hike 2 more times in 2019. And then just the whole thing just kind of fell apart. Like everything just fell apart, right? The stock market just tanked. Come 2019, Fed does a 180 and says, actually, we're going to cut rates. We're going to cut rates by a lot, right? No more rate hikes. So I think that's that channel that you just mentioned. When you hike rates, you're basically destroying a lot of market value in the fixed income world.
Yeah. And
that feeds through to all their asset prices, right? If you're losing money on your bonds, you know, you got to sell some equities to rebalance. And I think it's very clear that the financial markets can't handle higher interest rates. That's just not how they're built. And so if rate hikes have a big effect on slowing inflation, it's probably going to be through the financial channel. So let's say we have another meltdown, and you know, every time we have a meltdown, commodity prices go down a lot, if only because they're purchased by highly levered speculators and they get margin calls. But yeah, you know what I mean?
You know, what's fascinating is, the main thing that we want to point out and that this article does beautifully is there are a lot of cross currents out there, guys. There's no just one direction. There's never inflation or deflation. There's always both. It's just, you know, there are these fault lines that are just kind of tectonic plates that are pushing against each other. And it's just which one has kind of more power at the time. And that's what comes to mind when I think of commodity prices, because we're talking about how this reverse wealth effect that you described in this paragraph, but yet at the same time, we're talking about a lot of new dollars coming into the system, actually chasing commodities, which are a scarce resource.
No, so, I'm really bullish on commodities, and I think that if we have a financial panic, you know, it would be just a correction. I mean, think about the S&P, right? We kind of tanked badly in 2018, tanked badly in 2020, and then we just go straight up back up. So,
So the overall trend is higher because the probability is higher that we're going to see more and more dollar creation moving forward, whether it's a direct result of the government or banks lending more. This puts upward pressure on commodities, especially when we have all these supply chain issues and labor shortages. And then, but if we do have, higher rates, if they actually crash some of these risk parity portfolios because they've got bonds on leverage, then we could see a short-term dip because everyone is selling anything they can to get liquid, and that could include commodity producers.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I think, yeah, that's right. And, you know, sometimes some of those stocks aren't very liquid, so just a little bit of selling can change their price a lot.
Yeah. Okay, great. So Josh is saying we've got a question. Okay, can you comment on how Basel III or any other changes affects, as far as regulation, affect banks' balance sheet capacity? For example, if banks have to cover 100% of a gold position, they wouldn't be able to lend against it.
So Basel III has a tremendous impact on the bank balance sheet capacity. So Basel III wants to make the banking system safer, right? So it does that in a number of ways. One way is to make sure it has high quality assets. The other way is to make sure it has liabilities that are longer term that won't run. But just as a backstop to all that, it has something called a leverage ratio, and that limits how big a bank can get with respect to their a certain level of capital. So let's say that you have, you know, 20 times leverage ratio. If you have $5 in capital, then you can only have $100 in assets. So that's a limit on the size of the banking sheet. So if a bank held gold on their balance sheet, so how that would just count against their leverage ratio, right? So, you know, leverage ratio was unweighted, so all assets are treated equally. So it would just be $100 on their balance sheet. But where it would potentially have other impacts would be through the capital ratio. And that's when things are risk weighted.
Right.
So, right. Yeah. So leverage ratio, you just look at assets and, you know, divided by equity over assets, but that's simplification. There's more to that. But when you look at your capital ratio, though, you want to make sure that, for example, if you have risky loans, that you want to hold more capital against that. If you have safer loans or super safe assets like treasuries, then you know you don't really have to hold capital against that. So that's another constraint on the bank's balance sheet that constrains the composition of their assets. Now that's where you would see gold coming in. Now, off the top of my head, I don't know what the risk weights for gold are. I mean, if you look at, for example, Bitcoin that we were just kind of talking about, the Basel were just talking about, risk weights are extremely high. No bank is ever going to own Bitcoin. That's just how it is. But for gold, I don't know.
Does the Fed care about the value of the dollar?
So the value of the dollar, you can think about it in two ways. You can think about it as across exchanges, right? So Euro USD, Euro JPY, that's the FX cross. That exchange stuff is managed by the U.S. Treasury. And so the U.S. Treasury has purview over that. And then they decide if the dollar is, you know, I mean, Nixon devalued the dollar. I took it off the gold, right? So they can decide whether or not they want to do something with that. But another way you can think about the value of the dollar is inflation. How many goods or services my dollars can purchase, right?
Yep,
and that's within the Fed's purview. So in that sense, the Fed cares very much about the value of the dollar. It wants inflation to be, you know, stable, averaging about 2%. So that's where that comes in. And that's why the Fed is, you know, kind of worried right now.
We all know you buy stonks. At the New York Fed. Just say no, but not yet.
That's great. That's great.
That is funny.
Well, we know very many important people at the Fed buy stocks, right?
Well, yeah, we know now. That's right. And I know that Yellen has talked about potentially buying stocks. And then this new gal, I guess the Russian gal, I think she kind of looks Asian, but I think she's Russian. That Biden, I don't know if he's already hired her.
Yeah, she's like Central Asian. She seems like, I think she's from Kazakhstan. So,
okay. Yeah, she's talking about more like MMT kind of type talk and then also buying stock. So I'd love to get your opinion on that. And then last, I want to get your opinion on who do you think is going to be the next Fed chair?
So Almarova is Biden's nominee for comptroller of the currency, which is one of the top bank regulators, and she has many unconventional views. So she wrote this paper that basically says that, you know what, guys, I think everyone should just have an account at the Fed, like a CBDC, and you know what, the Fed would decide who gets money. So the Fed would be like, we'll just have one bank, it's the Fed, and everyone else would just, you know, go to the Fed for money, and you know, we'll basically decide who gets money. That's her main idea. One of their other ideas in that paper is that, you know what, maybe we should just have the New York Fed buy and sell stocks. When the stocks are overvalued, we'll just have the New York Fed sell, and when the stocks are undervalued, we'll just have the New York Fed buy. Basically managed markets, right? So easy, right? Just buy low and sell. I'm sorry. Sell high and buy low. So easy. If only it were so easy.
Yeah, well, that we've been obviously talking about that on this channel and George Gammon channel for quite some time with the central bank digital currency. So it doesn't surprise me at all. I think the probability of us getting there is high over the long run. I think we'll get there faster if we see a big market correction, but we'll have to wait and see how
her
it plays
paper
out.
Is scary. Is just scary stuff, and I can't believe that she's nominated for such a high position.
Yeah. So who do you think is going to be the next Fed chair?
You know, we have Yellen today campaigning for Powell, right? Saying good stuff about him. So, I think there's something happening with the politics behind this. You know, we saw a couple of Fed presidents kind of resign, and these tended to be hawkish. We have stories leaked out about, let's say, Jerome's trading, and there's nothing wrong with that I saw anyway. So it seems like some people are basically trying to maybe change the composition, maybe take over the Fed and implement their ideas that were probably very unpopular.
Yeah, you think Brainerd has a chance?
I think if she were to become Fed chair, she would be on Team CBDC, and we would move towards more towards Almarova's view.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that she's. I think the Biden administration is becoming increasingly unpopular, so that makes it difficult for them to do things that are too radical. So it seems like the safer thing right now would just be to stay with Powell.
Yeah, yeah. All right, buddy, I sincerely appreciate your time, and thanks for coming on and explaining that incredible article. I can't wait to do the whiteboard video on it. I just want to remind everyone that you're going to be speaking at Rebel Capitalist Live. So if you guys haven't gotten your tickets, that's in Houston, January 7th through the 9th. You definitely got to check out rebelcapitalistlive.com and get your tickets ASAP before they sell out. So, Joseph, enjoy the rest of your day, and I can't wait to see you in Houston, my friend.
Look forward to meeting all of you.
All right. Have a good one.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you, you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, Luke Groman, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.